Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Since New Hampshire started tracking COVID-19 almost 3 months ago, 223 people have died of the disease. And yesterday, there were 9 new deaths. But even as the toll mounts, there's still so much we're just beginning to understand about this virus and uncertainty about what the future holds. Today in The Exchange, an update on the coronavirus with the state's 2 top public health doctors. And Exchange listeners, we'd really like to hear from you. What do you want to know about this virus? Protecting yourself, its progression here in our state. Join us with an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Joining us for the hour are Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center and the deputy state epidemiologist. Welcome to both of you. And Dr. Chan, I want to start with you. As we approach summer here in New Hampshire, how does that affect the way that you are watching the progression of this virus in our state?
Yeah, and good morning, and good morning to your listeners as well. You know, the way that we're watching this virus over the summer months is the same way that we've been watching the virus over the last few months, right? Remember that our first case was identified and reported out in New Hampshire at the beginning of March. So we've been dealing with this virus now for coming up on 3 months. And we've been following very closely a number of different metrics or measures, if you will. Some of these people I've heard talked about in the media a lot. You know, we're obviously tracking the number of people infected with COVID-19. We're looking at our testing numbers and trying to test people more and looking at the proportion of those who are tested that are ultimately positive, right? So the more transmission we see in the community, we believe that you would find a higher percentage of tests that end up positive. We're following very closely the numbers of hospitalizations, looking at the unfortunate outcomes of death and people dying from COVID-19, responding to outbreaks and keeping track of outbreaks and helping facilities bring outbreaks within facilities under control. I think that the issue with summer is that summer brings some new challenges, right? There's new activities that people want to do. The weather is getting warmer. People want to be outside. We encourage people to be outside and exercising and staying healthy. But there are, you know, additional risks that come with summer and people being outside and congregating. And so that's certainly something we're trying to get the message out about, that people still need to be socially distanced. We're not relaxing social distancing, even though we are potentially reopening slowly and gradually some businesses. Social distancing is very much still in place, and it's still one of the key tools for helping to control this pandemic in New Hampshire, so that we don't see an increase in infections and an increase in hospitalizations and an increase in the number of deaths, for example.
So you mentioned more people outside, and that is for sure the case. How much safer, Dr. Chan, is it to be with others, again, you know, 6 feet apart, but still outdoors versus indoors? So could that be a benefit to us?
Yeah, and definitely we believe that being outdoors helps to mitigate or reduce the risk of being exposed and infected from COVID-19. But, you know, largely because you have, you know, more air circulation outside, larger spaces, larger open air. The ultraviolet light from the sun, we know, inactivates and kills many different types of organisms. But obviously that doesn't necessarily happen right away. So we believe that the risk is lower. And if your listeners have paid attention to a lot of the reopening discussions that have been happening, a lot of what has been reopening, especially up front, are outdoor activities. For example, restaurants with outdoor seating only. And so we believe that outdoor activities are lower risk, but the risk isn't zero, right? And so even when people are outdoors, there's still a necessity for people to be social distancing, staying at least 6 feet away from other people. We do encourage cloth face mask use, prevent spread of respiratory droplets between people, even when outdoors, if around other people, for example, waiting in line, you know, at an ice cream shop, for example, right? People should be socially distanced. We encourage people to wear cloth face coverings, practice good hand hygiene. All the same stuff that we say over and over every year still applies as we go into the summer.
And Dr. Talbot, to you too, as you think about summer and people getting out, and also what Dr. Chan said about the sunlight in terms of how it impacts the virus, what are you thinking about? What's on your mind this time of year?
We're hearing questions that are unique to the season. So one is whether swimming is okay. You know, is it possible that this virus finds itself in natural bodies of water or swimming pools and can transmit that way? And I really do think that the good news on that is that it doesn't appear so, that this is a virus that wants to spread from person to person through these respiratory droplets, and it's not going to exploit a well-maintained pool or our natural bodies of water. So I think that's good news. The other question I'm hearing unique to this season is around air conditioning and fans. So there is a report from Wuhan, China, that tells a very interesting and unique story. So I'm going to tell it because I think that it frames why we're getting so many questions. The media has been very interested in this event in a restaurant where somebody who was highly symptomatic was sitting in front of an air blower in a closed restaurant. And it does appear that as she coughed and sneezed, it blew her droplets to the two nearby tables. And this has cast doubt over the safety of air conditioners and fans, but most experts agree that this is not an ordinary or a concerning situation. It was just speaking to the fact that people who are symptomatic should not be out in public and that cloth face coverings will prevent that kind of event. And in fact, as we weigh risk benefit, obviously people will need to have a safe air temperature.
Go ahead, Dr. Talbot. Sorry.
Just the one last thing about the hot weather. I want to make a point. I am a total advocate for the cloth face covering, right? It protects those around you. It also can serve to prevent you from auto-inoculating or touching yourself, giving yourself the virus from touching contaminated surfaces. But I'm hearing as a clinician that there may be some risk to people who have breathing disorders or are susceptible to heat and have trouble wearing that mask. So I also want to make sure that we give a nod to the fact that wearing a mask is not for every person with severe medical conditions or for very young children. But otherwise, please do try to continue to wear your cloth face covering.
You know, you mentioned pools, Dr. Talbot, and Dr. Chan, I did want to ask you about that. We reported on Monday that Tuesday, that the city of Manchester has closed its pools for the summer. Other cities and towns are looking at whether to open public pools or not. And it's been pretty well reported that in the chlorine in the water, there's no spread. It's more just person to person by the side of the pool. How are communities supposed to make these decisions, Dr. Chan? You know, you're talking about risk analysis. If the pools are closed, people might go to the quarries or the river where there are also risks of, you know, uncertain water conditions. So how do you sort that out, Dr. Chan?
Yeah, so great question. And that's a question we've been getting frequently as well about pools. And I just want to reiterate what you said and what Dr. Talbot said, which is we do not believe there's a risk of transmitting COVID-19 through the water. But the concern is the close interpersonal contact between people in settings like pools can potentially spread the virus. So person to person, and pools are areas that are typically, you know, smaller enclosed areas where people may be playing in close proximity to one another, in close contact to one another, kids, for example. And so there absolutely is a risk for one person with COVID-19 spreading it to another person, whether they're, you know, playing in a pool or sitting on the poolside next to each other. There is risk still for person-to-person transmission. And so the question about what's going to happen with pools, how do people stay cool this summer, I think there's a couple points to be made here. One is that there is a group of individuals, a task force that the governor has appointed that is looking at how to safely reopen and conduct functions in society, like parks and pools and that sort of thing. Pools are not, the recommendation is that pools are not yet safe to be open because of the close confined area that people would gather or congregate in. There are other options, however. The state parks, state beaches, outdoor bodies of water remain open. The governor announced last week, I believe it was last week, time gets a little funny.
COVID-19,
that, you know, the seacoast beaches are open. So there are fresh natural bodies of water which remain open and available for the public. And, you know, it is important for people to stay cool and be able to recreate this summer. And, you know, there are options even with the home, within the home environment. I was listening to reports on the radio, you know, people, you know, going out and buying, you know, pools for their houses this summer and sprinklers. And, you know, so there are other ways to stay cool and stay refreshed. But for right now, public pools, swimming pools should not open because of the higher risk.
All right. Well, I want to invite our listeners to join us again. Our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, we are checking in with Dr. Chan and Dr. Talbot, the state's two top public health doctors, about how the coronavirus has been progressing, changing, evolving in our state over the past almost 3 months. And what special concerns are coming up around summer? Again, we welcome your questions. You can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. And Stacy is calling in from Nashua, both of you. Hi, Stacy. Thank you for being on the air with us. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead,
so
Stacy.
So here's my question. So I'm in my early 60s. My husband is close to 70. And we have a 22-year-old son who we haven't been in person with since the beginning of COVID. We've been super careful. We both have some health issues. I would like to integrate him back into my life. And I'm wondering, my thought was maybe have him get a test and then have him isolate for 2 weeks. Is there any way for me to safely get my boy home?
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for calling, Stacy. And Dr. Talbot, can you address that question? And we're hearing more and more just people really hurting because they can't see or touch their loved ones. Thanks again, Stacy. Go ahead, Dr. Talbot.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Stacy. And it's a vivid reminder of how much people have sacrificed and suffered as a result of this on so many levels. So really kudos to you for maintaining that safety for you and your husband. And it is a question that we're hearing increasingly that there's an obvious desire to get back with friends and family and loved ones, and your scenario is a common one. There are requests on several levels. One, is it safe to meet loved ones outside under some of these presumably safer conditions that the outdoor might bring us with the UV light and the air circulation? Can you maintain 6 feet from that loved one? Can you commit to wearing a mask under those circumstances? I think that is likely a safe way. You're suggesting another way that people are trying to strategize around this, and that is in these so-called quarantine bubbles, so that when a person commits with another to go through a 14-day quarantine to make sure that if they are incubating illness, that it's a chance to run through, then they wonder if they can create a circle of people that they commit to not being out in public and not risking acquisition. And I think this needs to be done thoughtfully, but probably is a safe strategy. You mentioned also testing, and I'm really glad for that because it's a topic that's near and dear to my heart. As we get more tools in that toolbox of detecting disease, I want to just make that very definite difference between the PCR test, the polymerase chain reaction test, which is appropriate for acutely ill people, and the antibody test, which reflects your body's memory to having had disease likely more than 2 weeks ago. And sometimes
sorry to jump in, Dr. Talbot. So PCR is sort of, do I have coronavirus or not? antibody is, did I have it in the past? Is that right?
I think that's a fine simplification. Sure. Yeah. So when someone has symptoms or there's a suspicion of active disease, PCR is the test. And Dr. Tan mentioned too, but it's a very active place within public health to ramp up this access to testing. So I think that many of you are aware of the Department of Health website now that lists the different places you can get that test for acute disease, that PCR test. So if you haven't seen that, I think it's really a new landscape. And I use landscape intentionally because there's even a map. So you can see where the closest place is, that if you have any symptoms, you know, you've heard them all before, but suspicion of fever, chills, myalgias, those muscle aches, is what that means, or any sense of illness, the unique feature of losing your smell or a sense of taste, then I do encourage you to seek testing for acute disease using the PCR. And then the antibody test, we can explore together what role that might have for satisfying people's curiosity about whether they've had disease in the past.
Yeah, we should definitely talk in a few minutes about, you know, the value of antibody testing, what it offers and what it does not offer. Some people view this as a quote unquote immunity passport. Turns out that's not really quite the case. A couple other questions from our listeners, though. One, again, on this theme of summer, Linda wrote to our survey. She says, can you have an outside cookout with friends if you stay and keep everything 6 feet apart like the restaurants are? And Dr. Talbot, what do you think?
I like to hear those keywords of 6 feet apart, cloth face coverings, hand hygiene, making sure that you're still adhering to all that. But otherwise, I do think it's time to consider ways that we can get back to our mental health and our social health and others. But, you know, given, again, that so many people have suffered and sacrificed to get us to this place of epidemic plateau in the state of New Hampshire, let's not give up. Let's not slip back. Let's not forego these ways that we got to this good place. So please do look to safe ways to get together with loved ones.
Well, and, you know, 4th of July will be here before long, Dr. Chan, and I'm sure a lot of people will have a question like Linda's. So, Linda, thank you for writing. What about, this is getting very specific, Dr. Chan, but I think people really want this information. If you have a cookout, do you share food or do you say, everybody make your own burger at home and bring it? I mean, do you want to, a neighbor of mine said, what are we going to do this summer? Everybody's going to need their own chip bowl. So what do you think, Dr. Chan? Can you have sort of a shared banquet at your 4th of July cookout, or should everybody just bring their own?
It's a great question. And a lot of times it comes down to the details, you know, and just to reiterate what Dr. Talbot said, you know, we want people to get outdoors. Having, you know, some friends over for a small cookout outdoors is likely okay. You know, again, we do recommend that people limit the group size as much as possible. You know, the group gathering size of 10 or less is still in effect as a requirement statewide. But it is acceptable and appropriate for people to be getting together with some friends or family in the outdoor setting, and, you know, maintaining the 6 feet social distancing. And I would say that, you know, as much as people can avoid sharing of utensils, for example, sharing of cups, certainly nobody should be sharing the drinking from the same cup, for example. You know, this is primarily spread person to person through close contact. And we define close contact as being within, you know, 6 feet. But as we see with many different infections and viruses, there is also the theoretical risk of fomite transmission. And by fomite transmission, we talk about this virus being transmitted from surfaces that have been contaminated with the virus, right? So somebody coughs into their hand, they touch a serving spoon, somebody comes along, you know, and touches that same serving spoon and then touches their eyes, nose, or mouth. And if that virus was on that surface, you know, especially within the first minutes to hours after someone touches it, they can infect themselves by you know, hand contact with surfaces.
So don't share utensils.
Right.
Don't anything.
Share drinks. And, you know, so as much as people can, you know, avoid those type of situations, I think the better off we're going to be.
I got a couple emails here for both of you about contact tracing. So we should definitely talk about that. Diane in Manchester says, what is required to becoming a contact tracer? Is completing the Johns Hopkins contact tracer course sufficient? Is this something that one can volunteer to do? Elizabeth and Rye also wanted to know about this. She says, will New Hampshire begin a more robust contact tracing program? Will we know if some place we have been has had a case of COVID? Is it a requirement to report cases, for example? If you ate at a restaurant and then came down with COVID the next day, Elizabeth also wants to know, if they will expand the number of tracers, how would one get training? So two questions there about contact tracing. And Dr. Chan, just remind us very briefly what contact tracers do, and then we can talk about efforts to ramp up that program.
Yeah, and that's a great question. And contact tracing is something that's conducted by public health, and public health structure is different in every state. So sometimes contact tracing is conducted at the local level if there are local health departments. Many other states have local or county health departments. New Hampshire has a centralized public health structure, so a lot of the contact tracing is conducted at a state level. We do have the Manchester and Nashua health departments that we're partnering and working with to do some of this contact tracing. But contact tracing essentially is the process by which a disease is reported to public health, and our public health nurses and disease investigators take that preliminary information and they reach out to get details on who was infected, when they were infected, when their symptoms began, and all of this is obviously kept very confidential. And we use that information to identify when someone may have been infectious, meaning what the time period is they could have spread it to other people. And then we ask that individual who they were in close contact with over that time, whether it's family or friends or at work, maybe going out into a public setting or a public meeting. And we then reach out to those close contacts and inform them, trying to be as confidential as possible, that they potentially were exposed to, in this case, COVID-19, and need to quarantine. So the sick individual who is diagnosed with COVID-19 is isolated. You know, can't go out in public. They're isolated, ideally at home. They need hospitalization. They're isolated in the hospital. The close contacts who are exposed but not yet known to be infected are quarantined. So isolated is for infected sick people. Quarantine are for close contacts. The end result is essentially the same. Everybody needs to be staying at home and out of public spaces, and that's the purpose of testing and doing contact tracing.
Wow. So if somebody was at a cookout over the weekend when it was so lovely, and then they found out that somebody who was at their cookout was infected with COVID-19, that person would also have to quarantine themselves, Dr. Chan, for 2 weeks, even if they felt fine.
Potentially, yes. And it depends on the level of interaction, how, you know, close someone was. We make those assessments through our investigations, but likely if someone was at a small cookout, potentially in close contact, they would need to quarantine. And that is how we help control the spread of this virus within the community.
And just very briefly, Dr. Chan, how does one become a contact tracer? Certainly there are a lot of people who've not working as much as they used to or lost their jobs. A lot of college and high school students who have no prospect of summer jobs. I don't know if they're too young to do this, but who can become a contact tracer?
Yeah, and this is a great question, and we get this. We've been asked this question a lot, and we certainly appreciate people's enthusiasm for being involved and interest in helping to control this virus. As I mentioned, much of the contact tracing in New Hampshire is conducted at the state level. So, you know, we have a large team in Concord. Contact tracing generally involves someone being within our public health operations center, where we have established a space and a whole group of people already to do contact tracing from a centralized location. You know, we have through a variety of means, you know, contracts with healthcare agencies. With the National Guard, we have brought on already additional contact tracers, and have, I believe, at least tripled our staff to be doing the public health contact tracing out of our centralized location in Concord. And so we appreciate people's interest. We have staffed up, but it's a little bit difficult to be, you know, bringing on, you know, individuals from all over the state. And so I think we look first to centralized mechanisms, groups, like contracts with healthcare agencies, the National Guard, to try and, you know, in a coordinated way, bring on and staff up our contact tracing efforts in Concord. But certainly we there are training programs out there that we have made available to those that we bring on and doing the effort in Concord with us.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will talk about some concerning symptoms on younger people, including multisystem inflammatory syndrome that you heard about last week. Also, long-term care facilities and what has been happening with COVID-19 there. We'll keep taking your questions and comments, so thank you for those. Our email exchange at nhpr.org and our phone number 1-800-892-6477.
Staying connected is so important right now, and NHPR is committed to being a place where we can all come together to stay informed as a community. I'm Rick Gamley, host of Morning Edition. The trusted news coverage you hear every day on NHPR is made possible because a community of listeners value this essential service enough to pitch in. Please join them as an NHPR sustaining member for just $10 a month. It's quick and easy at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, as summer approaches, Granite Staters get outside and more businesses open up, what are the state's top public health doctors looking at with coronavirus? We're finding out. We're talking with Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and the state's deputy epidemiologist. And we've been hearing a lot from you. Keep your questions and comments coming in. Our email is exchange at nhpr.org. Once again, exchange at nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. A question about testing just came in that I'd like to share with you, and I'll throw it to you, Dr. Talbot, please. David writes from Meredith, there has been a lot of discussion on ramping up testing so everyone can get tested, but as infection can happen at any time, doesn't this mean that everyone whom has not had COVID-19 in the past must get tested every day? Is it even feasible to test 300 million people every day, which would mean 2.1 billion tests per week? Given, David says, that we're only at about 3 million tests nationwide per week now, seems like a far stretch. Lastly, David asks, and David, thank you for this, if not, what are the alternatives that are feasible as we cannot wait 12 to 24 months for a vaccine? Lots to unpack there. Thank you again, David. And Dr. Talbot, I've had this question too. You get tested for COVID-19. Okay, so maybe you don't have it today, but you could get it tomorrow. So how do you sort of, what's the usefulness of this testing? Obviously, it's useful, but maybe not quite as useful as we think. Go ahead, Dr. Talbot, please.
You're right. There's a lot to unpack there. Lots of very important questions that speak to, I think, two major issues. One is, yes, the PCR, this common test that most people are familiar with, is intended to identify people who have been recently or acutely infected. So if you're a person who's maintaining the social distancing, the cloth face covering, et cetera, then you presumably have minimal risk. And there's no strategy afoot for daily testing. That seems exuberant. And what we do in public health is certainly strategize. We look for a strategy that identifies the highest yield persons, those persons most likely to be transmitting to the most number of people.
So, like people who work at long-term care facilities.
There's that, but also people who are most vulnerable to disease for prognostic indications. So we're testing people who are likely to contribute to transmission and those who are most likely to suffer the worst outcomes by having disease. So ramping up, but logically so. The current recommendation is not for just everyone to go in and get a PCR test. But you've been hearing from Commissioner Chibonet and the governor and Dr. Chan, too, the rollout of testing. What makes sense for this still limited resource? What's the right strategy that this to let this testing help us control the epidemic in our state?
So how helpful is it then, as David points out, you know, again, you could be fine today, but not fine tomorrow. So what does it really tell us? I mean, I guess it tells you that you don't have it that day, but go ahead, Dr. Talbot. I'm still not sure I'm really understanding.
So, sure, it represents a snapshot. So you've captured that. And I don't see, again, the risk is so high that daily testing makes sense for the average person who's participating in the restrictive, or, you know, the cloth face coverings and hand washing and all that. Like you're not pulling this out of the air. You know, it's about being in contact with people. So we look for testing people who are at some risk of having disease. So you're right. If you test today, it tells you that you don't have virus RNA in your, you know, virus genetic material in your nose or throat. It doesn't tell you you won't in the next days. It's not a predictive test.
Interesting. So, for example, Dr. Talbot, I'm working from home. I'm not going out, you know, with large groups of people, certainly, and not really seeing very many people, although I do have to grocery shop like everybody else. I have a friend, however, who is a visiting nurse. So she's going into people's homes. She's, you know, working pretty much hands-on with older people and people with problems. So maybe I don't need to be tested, but maybe she should be tested once a week. I mean, is that kind of an example that makes sense, Dr. Talbot?
It's a great example. So again, who is most likely to acquire disease or to get this? And who's most likely then to spread it, especially to vulnerable persons. So, right, if you're adhering, as you've described, Laura, then I just don't see you at risk. You know, it's not coming in through the window or, you know, on the mail. That's just not how this is propagating in our communities. Whereas, in your example, somebody who has an inability to stay 6 feet from somebody and is in contact with people who actually may be infected, is somebody we're testing more regularly, hence the long-term care facility testing programs we have where there is serial testing. So this is the classic and appropriate population for this kind of regular testing. So these programs have been announced that we are testing all staff every 7 days and a sample of residents throughout our state to try to identify disease transmission as early as possible. Dr. Chan has a follow-on, I think.
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Chan. Thanks.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, you know, this is one of those situations where we're not only still learning about the virus and how easily it's transmitted, right? I mean, our knowledge of this virus today is very different from what it was even a few months ago. And part of this learning has been about how to best use tests and what is the testing strategy. And so these are actually discussions on how to test and how to best use the test and how to best identify people that might be infected, to do those nasal swabs, those PCR-based tests to detect people that are infected, either with symptoms or, you know, possibly asymptomatic. And so these are discussions that are still happening not only in New Hampshire, but even at a national level. I've been on calls with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention where these exact questions and conversations are happening at a national level about how do you test? How do you use the test? How frequently do you test? And so I think people can expect to see changing recommendations around, you know, who to test and how frequently to test. It's just the nature of the situation we're in trying to control this pandemic. But I think it's important, and this gets at the root of the caller's question, is that, you know, testing is only one tool in our toolkit to try and rapidly identify people infected so that we can, you know, isolate them and do our contact tracing. Right, that is one containment strategy, one tool to try and contain spread of this infection. And I think it goes back to that, you know, nothing is going to be perfect that we do. That testing is not going to detect 100% of people out there with infection, and so we still need to rely on the social distancing. People need to be avoiding public settings, going out for the essentials. When they're out, you know, staying 6 feet from other people, using cloth face coverings if they're able to. We still need to rely on those social distancing strategies to try and control this disease, because there are, imperfect testing strategies that are out there.
Yeah, well, and that gets to David's other question, which is such a good one. What alternatives are feasible given that, as he says, we cannot wait 12, 24 months for a vaccine? So it sounds like you just answered that, Dr. Chan. Basically, stick with the program, the cloth masks, the 6 feet of distancing, the, not going out to large gatherings and so forth. The World Health Organization, toward that end, said just recently that it is concerned as summer approaches and people do want to get out and do start to gather. And we certainly saw pictures of this over Memorial Day weekend. They're talking about a summer spike, not even fall surge, which we should talk about later, but a summer spike. What do you think about that, Dr. Talbot?
I think that we're vulnerable, right? I think that if we relax the measures we've described and are careless with our, you leave your mask in your car, you forget your little bottle of alcohol-based hand rub, whatever, that we will absolutely see this one. This is something that I feel very passionate about. I absolutely feel it myself that we have been at this a long time and it's really getting old.
It sure is.
And framing this, though, it's a marathon, not a sprint. Here in New Hampshire, we can do this together. We all commit to it. How about we see who can get the funniest tan this summer because you're wearing a mask? So everybody's going to have tan foreheads and, pale around the face. Like, really, I just feel like we need a campaign where we invigorate, we empower one another to keep up this momentum, or we will see the summer spike.
Dr. Talbot, when you are out and about, again, at some point you have to go to the grocery store. I tried the delivery option. It did not work for me. So how do you feel when you see people who are not masked, Dr. Talbot? I had to buy some air conditioners yesterday, went to 2 different Home Depots. Most people were masked, but I'd say a good 15 to 20% were not. Do you say anything to people, Dr. Talbot, when you see them unmasked?
I don't.
Are you tempted?
It's certainly a reminder to me to stand 6 feet from them and to not use that same shopping cart, honestly. But I do also want to approach this with compassion that not everyone can tolerate the mask, but we need everyone who can to do so. This is not a political issue. This is a health issue for all of us. So I'll defer to Dr. Chan, who also feels very strongly about this.
Well, and Dr. Chan, I know this is an uncomfortable question for you, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I mean, would your job be made easier if the governor did what Maine and Massachusetts did and just mandated masks?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and there's been a lot of there's been a lot of focus on mandating masks, and I think whether masks are mandated or not, we are strongly recommending and asking people to wear cloth face masks, and I think to your earlier question as well, I think there's 2 different sides of this coin, right? There's the side from the businesses, and then there's the individual responsibility, and I think we're trying to get the message out on both fronts, that as an individual, there's a collective responsibility for each person in our society to take steps to not only protect themselves, but also to protect their families, their friends, other people in their community from transmission of this virus. And so those are the steps we talk about frequently, social distancing, wearing cloth face coverings. Remember, cloth face coverings are meant to protect other people around the person wearing the cloth face mask. It's what we call source control in the event that someone is asymptomatically shedding this virus, right? So there is the individual responsibility. But to your earlier question, there's also the business responsibility. And that's what I think people have seen coming out and talked a lot about in around the reopening of different sectors of, the economy, different businesses. There is guidance out there that we have reviewed and tried to put public health protections into that guidance for how businesses can safely operate and how customers, clients can visit those establishments under those precautions to do so safely and minimize the spread of this virus in a setting of like a retail store, for example. And so I would say that it's the responsibility, not necessarily of Dr. Talbot, who sees you know, a customer in the store, you know, and doesn't know that person, but it's the responsibility of the businesses to be reviewing that guidance and taking the appropriate action, because it's built into that guidance that not only should employees be wearing face masks, but in some circumstances, clients or customers, if there's close one-on-one contact, for example, at a hairdresser, the customer needs to be wearing a cloth face covering as well. But those businesses should be, at a minimum, asking everybody in one form or another to be wearing a cloth face covering, whether it's a requirement or not.
So the state is not requiring it, Dr. Chan, but individual businesses like Home Depot, where I was yesterday, in Concord and Hooksett, so two of them, they could require masks for customers.
That is correct, yes.
Okay. All right, we've got to take a break. There's so much more to talk about when we come back, including the outbreaks that we've seen at long-term care facilities. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's been almost 3 months since New Hampshire started tracking the coronavirus in our state, and there's still so much we don't understand about it, from transmission to symptoms to immunity. We're talking with the state's two top public health doctors about this. They are Dr. Benjamin Chan, state epidemiologist for New Hampshire, and Dr. Elizabeth Talbot, infectious disease specialist at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center and the state's deputy epidemiologist. And we've been hearing from you. It's great to get your questions in at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange at nhpr.org. And I do want to ask both of you briefly about long-term care facilities and see also if we can get to some of these newer indications among young people linked to COVID-19. But as both of you know, most of the deaths from this have been at elder care facilities. That's been the trend nationally. But we here in New Hampshire, Dr. Chan, apparently have the highest percentage in the country. Why is that the case?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we do, a high percentage of our deaths are in people in residential care type facilities, like long-term care facilities. So we report out these numbers of the number of people who sadly have died from COVID or COVID-related complications every day. People can find those numbers and some of the data on our website. I think you mentioned in the beginning that, you know, there are a total of 223 people in New Hampshire that have died from COVID-19. And what we've said before, and that this is what you're asking about, is that about 79% of those people who have died are associated with long-term care facilities. And
wow, that's huge.
That's an unfortunate number, and it's a high percentage. And I think it speaks to currently where we are now in the outbreak, that much of the burden of disease and infection is occurring in these more congregate, close living settings, affecting the vulnerable individuals in our population. So people that might be older, people with multiple chronic medical conditions. And so we're spending a lot of time and effort trying to control these outbreaks, working with facilities to make sure they have implemented the proper infection control to prevent the virus from spreading person to person, you know, doing very aggressive testing strategies, you know, wearing the appropriate personal protective equipment. But I think that the challenge, these numbers speak to the challenge of how easily this virus spreads and how difficult it is to control it once it gets into these settings and once it starts spreading.
Well, it did take almost 2 months, Dr. Chan, before the state announced a testing program for nursing home residents and staff. And as we've learned, a lot of the times it's staff unknowingly bringing this into the facility. They're certainly not doing that on purpose. They're probably asymptomatic. Why did that take so long? 2 months is a really long time, given the vulnerability of this population.
So, you know, again, the timeline here gets a little fuzzy in my mind. I can't speak necessarily to the specifics of the timeline. But the way that I've seen this play out is that it's really been a progression, right, as we've learned about this virus and as we've learned how easily it transmits. And as you mentioned, the possibility of asymptomatic transmission, we've seen how introductions, and as you point out, many potentially asymptomatic introductions into long-term care facilities can fuel an outbreak. And so we have, I think what you've seen is adjusted our approach as we've learned more about this. And so where we are right now is a much more aggressive testing strategy, testing both staff and residents. But even before this most current, what you've heard in the media currently about a lot of the testing at long-term care facilities was a gradual progression up to this point. So going in and testing more aggressively of residents, for example, we were doing that, you know, several weeks ago even, as a way to try and identify, you know, residents who might be asymptomatic, to protect them, to inform what we call cohorting, grouping of residents who might be infected within a facility. So I think it's been a progression of increasing testing over the last couple of months as we've learned about this virus and seen it spread very easily.
One more question about this, and again, I'll throw it to you, Dr. Chan. At least one of the facilities, and there have been a lot of facilities in the news around this, but at least one, Greenbrier in Nashua, did have an institutional outbreak, is what's called a special focus facility. That's a designation from the federal government for facilities with a pattern of quality issues. A couple other facilities are candidates for that designation as well. Based on recent performance, what additional special attention, Dr. Chan, if any, did the state take to ensure these facilities, these special focus facilities, were prepared to deal with a crisis of this kind?
So I think that question probably it maybe pertains more to like our facilities and licensing group. But what I can say is that, you know, we are taking an aggressive approach to preventing outbreaks and controlling outbreaks in facilities, regardless of what the underlying licensing or, you know, potential designations or penalties are. You know, this is a virus that can impact any facility. And so we have a group of individuals through our what we call the healthcare associated infections group within public health that routinely works very closely with facilities to make sure that they have the appropriate personal protective equipment, that they're using it appropriately. We've certainly been working at developing guidance and working with the New Hampshire Healthcare Association to get the messaging out about, you know, guidance for all long-term care facilities. And then we have the ability to do an infection control assessment, either in person, or we've moved some of these assessments, these facility assessments, to, you know, virtual assessments to assess, you know, how well they're carrying out infection control procedures. And this is not something that we do depending on licensing questions or issues. We do this for all facilities.
Not just those that have gotten in, I don't want to say in trouble, but then have been of note because of some of their policies.
Correct. That's right.
I'd like to take a call, both of you. And this is Diane in Durham. Hi, Diane. You're on The Exchange. Good morning. Go ahead.
How are you?
Okay.
Yes, I have a question to the doctors, I guess specifically, one who is at Dartmouth and the other who is head of the public health system here, or at least infections. Being a resident of Durham, I have read the institutions of higher education guidelines from the CDC. They're quite complex, is how universities are supposed to prepare. My concern is that the students now are not observing very many of the guidelines. We had a party on Cinco de Mayo from some kids who either were here or came back, and then three of those kids were positive. We've had graduation celebrations outside, not in distance, no masks. I see students coming, or what I think are students, young people, going into the supermarket in groups, no masks, no distance. So how are we going to enforce this for, you know, the fall? And how are the universities going to be able to prepare for the complexities of keeping distance and all of that without a lot of support?
Well, Diane, thank you so much for calling. And there's a couple things that I'd like to follow up on there. Especially Diane reminds us there was a gathering of young people and three tested positive. And Dr. Talbot, I have to ask you this. It seems like early on in this crisis, there was so much emphasis on people over 60 being at risk. There was so much emphasis on if you don't feel well, stay at home. If you have a fever, stay at home. But now we're hearing, and Diane's reminding us, Dr. Talbot, young people can carry this disease, young people can get it, people can get together because they feel perfectly fine, and lo and behold, it turns out they have it. So I'd love your thoughts on Diane's comment broadly and more specifically about young people congregating.
It's a concerning situation for sure. It's hard to hear these stories. Again, it gets to my previous statement that I believe people are just getting tired of these requests to adhere to social distance, et cetera. But I think we need to invigorate, we need to enable, we need to educate. And right now, in relevant to Diane's question, that the university, I know, is, and universities like it, are certainly consulting, certainly aware of the guidance, asking about their own circumstances. And so we see it as a very important role for us in public health to provide the materials they need to make this happen for us all. So you're right, perhaps has the messaging been too heavily focused on those who are most likely to suffer and die, the elderly and chronically ill population? I don't think so. I think that it's appropriate for us to focus so much effort there, but people need to hear that they can serve as a source for infection of others. So whether you're 8 or 80, these apply to you. Okay, so...
Well,
absolutely. The universities and the colleges and the residential schools are going to offer us some unique challenges, and we need to think of creative ways to, again, enable and to educate.
And yet, Dr. Chan, I'm sure you're aware there's a lot out now, surveys and research and studies about the mental health impacts of this crisis, especially, it turns out, on young people who, you know, have the job anxiety and the school anxiety and, you know, sort of a time when your life is in flux and you can't get a hold of it when this virus is ongoing. So I just wonder what you think about that, Dr. Chan. You know, your role is public health. We've talked a lot about this virus and disease and the impacts and so forth. But as colleges hope to open up something that young people can at least grab onto, how is your office sort of going to help with that? Help people sort of navigate that line between mental health and physical health?
Yeah, no, that is a great question, and that has been a concern and something we've been watching around this pandemic from the beginning. And I think, and you know, we've said this before, that, you know, I think there's, as with many things, there's a balance to be had here, right? If you lock everything down and do it for prolonged periods of time, months and months and months, people are going to suffer not only economic consequences, right, but there's going to be significant emotional and mental health consequences for people being confined and socially isolated, frankly. If you open things up widely, then the pandemic virus is going to spread. It's going to cause more infection. We're going to, you know, get into a surge situation with where our healthcare system is overwhelmed, as we've seen in other states and in other countries. People are going to die. So as with many things, I think the question is, where is the balance? How do we learn to live with this virus?
Right. That's what people are looking for. Go ahead, Dr. Chan.
And be able to carry out normal societal functions in a safe way that is protective of people. And when I say protective, I mean not just protecting people from COVID-19, but protecting people's emotional and mental health, protecting people's economic well-being, which can have a long-term health impact. And I think there's a balance to be had there that we're learning and experiencing this in real time, how to do this. So the question about colleges in the fall is a very real and active question and a real active area of discussion. And I anticipate that there's going to be more guidance coming on this to help colleges and universities and institutions of higher education. I know that the task force, the governor's task force, is actively engaged in this. You know, we've had discussions with some school leaders around the state. And so this is going to be an ongoing discussion to try and figure out how to best live with this virus, especially in these settings where it can spread easily.
I have to ask you one last question, Dr. Talbot, and that is about a vaccine, which, of course, a lot of people are eagerly waiting for. But then I just read this morning, Dr. Talbot, that the vaccine is not a cure-all. The coronavirus will likely remain for decades to come. I'm quoting from the Washington Post here. Don't blame me. Circulating among the world's population and embracing that reality, again, quoting here, is crucial to the next phase of America's pandemic response. I just have to tell you, Dr. Talbot, I read this and I thought, okay, the vaccine isn't going to just make this all go away. just what are your thoughts there on the vaccine and how it may not save us all in one fell swoop?
We're watching this very closely, too.
Sure.
Read a very important initial survey of persons about their intentions regarding vaccination when it becomes available. And I have to say, it makes me lose sleep that only about half of people surveyed said that they would access this vaccine. So in the long and terrible history we have battling infectious diseases, it is vaccines that have turned things around. So I have been anticipating, indeed, that the vaccine would drive this down and allow us to get back toward normal. Maybe not make it disappear, but put it in a more endemic or, you know, part of daily life phase state. But I think that we all need to think right now what we're going to do when that vaccine becomes available and explore with your own doctor and read what you can. But I hope that we're all positioned to assess the safety and take a decision for our community. So there's a lot of talk at the highest level about how fast this vaccine development is happening. But I still trust the system. I still trust the randomized controlled trials, the gold standard of how we come to these tools and expect that this will be a tool that can help tremendously in our battle.
All right. And Dr. Talbot, I do apologize. I have to cut you off there. We had so much more we could have covered. Thanks to you, Dr. Talbot, and you, Dr. Chan, for joining us today. And we'll talk again. Thank you very much for being with us. And you're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.